off the ball rugby.
There was a goal in the two teams, and that was the most disheartening thing. And does that mean that Leicester can't come back? No, of course, like, of course they can rebuild, but the mountain is bigger than it's ever been.
Join in the obsession. Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.
Off the Ball Breakfast.
With Viagra Connect 50 milligram film-coated tablets. Contains sildenafil for adult men with erectile dysfunction. Maximum dosage 150 milligram tablet per day. Always read the label. Buy online at viagraconnect.ie. Subject to suitability following pharmacist consultation.
You know, yeah, to be there.
It was just great to say, like, or I was there for that. You know what I mean?
You have to be there. I wish I wasn't there. You have to be there.
All right, we've had actors, directors, stand-up comedians, sports stars on You Had To Be There over the last 4 years, but there truly is no place like home. We're bringing it back to the OGs. It's Jurgen and myself with Owen Sheehan. How exciting is this?
Very exciting.
This has been a long time coming, isn't it?
It has been stewing on this for a number of
hours,
minutes. Checked my list again, checked it twice, it's looking good.
How excited were you to get the call?
Very excited. It's a privilege. It's kind of a rite of passage for anybody who's worth their salt in modern Irish life.
We did something similar with you before your travels?
See, I thought that I had done it myself already, but it turned out I hadn't actually.
Oh, had you not? You're not like our first two-time guest.
I also thought when Owen suspected he had done it, I thought likewise. But I think the only internal you had to be there to date is John Duggan.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
That would have been a good one.
It was very good. It was exactly what you expected.
Well, how long ago was this? Did I do this?
No, this would have been... What part of your life, which we will delve into here deeply, were you in then? Were you travelling or was it Owen Sheehan part two?
Because I definitely talked to John about his experience at the Masters long after he was at the Masters for the first time. So I wondered, was it part of that or was that actually just a newfound conversation or something? He's got a great list anyway.
It's stunning. I want to say it was the Christmas before last that John Duggan did his. So that brings us in nicely to your life. Mm-hmm. Where were you then? And we'll work back off that. When have you been in the Owen Sheehan part two phase? How long?
As in, since when have I been presenting the Off the Ball program on News Talk?
No, when did you come back from your travels?
So how do you define these first part, second part? Continuity, Sheehan.
I came back just in time for the 2023 All-Ireland final between Kerry and Dublin.
Yes.
Which was great. A great thing to come home for. It rained for a solid month after that as well. It didn't.
You just felt like I did. It was all for 2 days.
I say that as if it was like some sort of like noble decision to come home. I was just completely broke. I was like, I thought you were going to do 12 months. No, 11. I wanted to come home for the football. I was completely broke.
Did you? I would have thought bang on 12 months. Okay.
No. I was away for 12 months. I didn't come back to work for another month.
But you were on with us during your travels sporadically.
Near the end, yeah.
From Peru?
Yeah. I think I was hoping that somebody would say send in an invoice there.
Did they not? No.
No.
Can you tell?
Desperate. I would have done anything at that point for a bit of cash.
Can I ask you this honestly now, all these years later, knowing you've solidified yourself in Irish broadcasting now as one of the main men, were you always going to come back?
Yeah. I knew particularly I was going to come back when I watched Ireland win the Grand Slam in 2023 in beautiful sunshine, and thought to myself, there's no place I'd rather be rather than in a studio in Dublin tomorrow talking about this. I was like, what is wrong with me? It's like, I'd love to be at work on Monday.
Why did you decide to have a hiatus?
I don't know. It was post-COVID.
Yeah.
I think COVID was tough on everybody. And it was kind of maybe a frustrating time in terms of not being able to travel all that much. And kind of felt like I'd maybe a few more years left in my 20s. Strike while the iron is hot. And also, a lot of my friends, a lot of my contemporaries would have bought houses and stuff with the money that they had saved up over COVID. I now regret not doing that. I blew it all on a year's travel instead. So that was another reason
I could do it.
I was privileged enough, Colm, to actually have the decision.
Yeah.
Like, I can actually just go away and not work for a year, and not everybody has that privilege. So in hindsight, I was very, very lucky to be able to do that.
We had wild oats to sow, Colm. We established this at the time.
It's such a, pardon the pun, seedy phrase, it's the sowing of the wild oats. But I guess I wonder where the oat trees are now.
Well, who knows?
Do you miss this?
Oh, big time, yeah, big time. I listen most mornings, to be fair. I was listening this morning. Listening to Arsenal not getting the due credit as per usual.
It took 14 and a half minutes.
How long it was?
LIV Golf was a big story, you know?
LIV Golf was a big story. I was surprised you didn't know what LIV stood for. I made a stupid joke when it was like, they were talking about going to 72 holes. And it was like, are they going to be calling it Livy golf? But whatever.
I would have got it. Yeah. Like I had to.
But that was obviously
we had
a few
to like spell it out like semaphore this morning. I was like, oh,
that was
Jesus.
A few months ago when
this joke landed.
Yeah, but
look at him, he's disgusted.
R.I.P. to Liv.
And you miss Owen.
I do, of course. Yeah.
It's you know, like we.
I can say all this now, but we literally rewrote the company handbook so we could have a career break. They didn't exist. It's like the Barbra Streisand effect. It's now when anybody in the wider Barra family gets to go off and travel and sow their wild oats. it's the Owen Sheehan effect. Owen Sheehan effect that they're accessing.
You're welcome, guys.
And when did you realise it was Owen Sheehan?
Oh, very late. His friends would tell us when we were in the pub, and I would just think they were joking. The Kerry Mafia, who are a very welcoming lot,
well,
especially when they're winning.
You mentioned the obviousness of the Liv, let's say, but you understood how the name was spelled.
It was spelled out to me in much the same way that I had to, and still it took me a while. And still I'm still, just because I think Owen was too polite to correct us at the start, a bit like Jeremy Lukeman was obviously too polite to correct people, and now it's gone too far.
The Lukeman thing is mad, all right? That's exactly what it is. I'd like to get Jeremy's thoughts on this whole subject, but it's a politeness. It's also, it doesn't really matter to me. I suspect he doesn't really care too much if people are calling him Lockman, which people will continue to do so, and you got to put the foot down. I don't even know how it came out, but if somebody asked me the question, I'd be like, that's Eddie Shea and not Sheehan. It's my name, but I don't really care. Like, if you want to, you can pronounce it, you can freestyle if you want.
You're well established now. I know you're not going to admit that. But you are. You're the main man. Where did it all start?
Which part of my life? Right? Like, what are we talking about?
You're born in London, England.
Conceived in London. Think it's that far back, will you?
Yeah, I could do, yeah. I was actually born in London. That's fair, yeah. Brought home as a five-year-old with this little five-year-old English accent. Had to assimilate into Kerry life. Withstand, you know, the senior infant bullying of a small child with an English accent, and then eventually that turned into something a little bit more Irish, and that's the very beginning of it all.
Were you sporty?
Would have played a good bit, very badly. I guess the greatest sort of concrete achievement I can point to on a sporting level is an All-Ireland bronze medal in Olympic handball in community games. So yeah, got the day out in Mosny, got the weekend out in Mosny, in fact, were beaten up by this brutish Carlow team who beat us in the All-Ireland semi-final. There were tears amongst our team. Not me, I was on the bench, barely played. but there were teams, tears rather from players who did play more minutes.
You were only physically there, but not mentally.
Yeah, I was on the bench. I did get more of a run out against Monaghan when we were, I think, four or five goals up in the bronze medal match.
Oh, they played a match for it. No losers.
No losers.
No, it's not like the boxing.
And I'm not sure where they're not like the boxing. No, funnily enough, 13-year-olds playing Olympic handball are allowed to go out and play again the very next day. And we did end up winning that game against the Monaghan parish and took home bronze. But there was a good Olympic handball culture within our parish. There had been a couple of gold medal teams in the years before us. I think as a small community, we had found a bit of a niche. And those, actually two niches. It was Olympic handball and rounders was the other thing that we were good at. And I remember winning a gold medal in rounders at Kerry level as well. And because, I don't know what the rule was, but we weren't allowed to proceed and go forth with both the rounders and the Olympic handball team. So there had to be a decision made. And they picked the Olympic handball team, but this was the year beforehand. So I was too young for it. And therefore, I didn't get to fill my Munster dreams of competing outside of the county. But thankfully, 12 months later, I did.
And I thought you were getting up. Yeah. I thought that was it.
That's my yeah.
So where did Gaelic football and soccer come into it for you?
Well, soccer came into it because I suppose I would have been an Arsenal fan as a child. My dad was a big Arsenal fan, still is a big Arsenal fan. And then Kerry is Kerry. Both parents from Kerry, lived in Kerry all my life. That was pretty straightforward. But that I guess, and mom as well, to be fair, when it comes to GAA, would be big sports fans. So they were kind of the two entry points. It's interesting, is it? Because like I often think, what would have happened in like those 2000s and early 2010s had like Ireland been a better team? Because like obviously, football is the most important sport, generally speaking, for any human being. And you kind of live it vicariously through whatever your team is that you support. And I wonder, like, would we all have a different relationship with the sport had Ireland been a little bit better? Had they qualified for the 06 World Cup, say, or even Euro 2008? Like, that little burst of 2002 that we got as kids, that was kind of it. I wonder.
Yeah. What's your first sporting memory, actually?
I think it's going to the Community Shield. What was the Community Shield? The Charity Shield in 1999 at Wembley. So this was Arsenal versus Manchester United. Arsenal won 2-1 on that occasion. Just remember.
It's the treble team. The Man United treble team.
1999.
If it was 99, it would have been, yeah.
Of course it would have been, yeah. I hadn't thought of that, actually. That's exactly what Arsenal got the better of them on that occasion. Never went to Highbury before it was knocked, weirdly. Went to a few London Irish games a lot over there. But again, vague memories. They're kind of the very faint memories. I think first GAA match maybe that I remember is 2000, and it was the Munster final played between Kerry and Clare that year, and I think it took place in Limerick. And Kerry obviously went on to win the All-Ireland that year, so that year is when things start to become more concrete. I remember being at the Armagh replay and the Galway replay, and then Thurles in 01, for example. So,
When is the picture of you and Morris Fitz from? Sometime around then?
Sometime, I presume 2000. Yeah, 2000 when Kerry won the All-Ireland down at the homecoming, which would have done a good tour of Kerry at that point. And I think Cara Sabine would have been a big point on that stop around the county. So I think that's when the picture's from. Picture of Paddy then as well. That probably would have been the first time when I would have got on the proper bandwagon of a supporting team.
Mm. A lot of people like fall into media or whatever, and they're like, "Oh my, go down this path." I always got the feeling you knew exactly what you wanted to do, or maybe not.
No, the only reason I wanted to do broadcast media is because my mother actually forced me to do a radio summer camp in Radio Kerry when I was 15 years of age. All I remember is that it was the day after Kerry beat Dublin in the 2009 quarterfinal, the start of the Earriggs game, and so I was around 15, and it was a bank holiday Monday the next day. That game took place on a bank holiday Monday, so it was the Tuesday after. And just getting woken up that morning, being told you're going to a radio summer camp was the last thing that I wanted to hear. Like, proper sort of hormonal teenager being like, I'm not doing anything you tell me to do, sort of thing. And also the idea, no offence to, I guess, myself, who's now a radio professional, the idea of radio seemed a little bit uncool and lame.
That's old.
Yeah, exactly. Ugh. Even in 2009, which is quite a boring thing for where I am in 2026 in life. But eventually I succumbed to that, and after day one I was like, oh, this is actually quite an enjoyable thing to do. I might actually pursue this and see where this would take me.
And so, leaving Cert Dhun, and you were always going to do something like this in college?
Yeah, I went to DCU then to do communications. And then a couple of years into DCU, got an email from Ger Gilroy.
Why did you do communications instead of journalism?
Because I didn't really know if I wanted to be like a hard-hitting journalist, which is what I assumed journalism was, which was completely wrong. I should have done journalism. That would have been a better thing to do, I think, because that's ultimately what I ended up doing. But communications was an interesting one because it was like a really interesting array of individuals who was in our class. There's a couple of people who went down the hard journalism path. Like, I mean, one of the other journalists who was in my class in DCU is Tommy Meskell, who's a 6-1 presenter now, who's done unbelievably well, obviously. But the vast majority of people didn't want to be journalists, and some of them are doing unbelievable stuff in the marketing worlds. Like, even just kind of like top of my head, I don't want to get her title wrong, but Pippa, who's a friend of mine at Whoop, who's a
global head of
like, she's done unbelievable stuff, and she was in our class in communications as well. So
was Sean Defoe in your class as well?
He was in our year, but in journalism.
Okay,
yeah, so he's obviously done very, very well. The journalism crew, the journalism year did well, and then our communications class was mad and wild and brilliant, and everybody's gone into vastly different places in their lives, which I think was actually a really good thing.
So at this point in communications, when you're doing that in DCU, do you now know what you want to do at that point for a career?
Yeah, like I definitely wanted to do something radio related. I just felt that the buzz that you get off live broadcast was nothing that you'd get off print. And at that time, it was broadcast or print. The online aspect was print on a website as opposed to social media.
That's right. What year did you graduate?
2015.
Yeah, you see, that was a big turning point, wasn't it?
And also, the other thing about it is that you're coming out of a recession as well at that point. So not only does does it feel like fairly basic in terms of what the media landscape is now, comparing it back then to 10 years later, but also in terms of jobs that are available. And it felt limiting and it felt small. And the plan was always like, come out of university and go to London. or emigrate, because that was the path that most people had treaded, I guess, in, you know, 2012, 13, 14, the years prior to me, that there were very few jobs coming up in media. And I guess because the economy is better now, and also there are infinite amounts of realistic opportunities for you in media compared to what it was 10 years ago, it felt low stakes, but also kind of exciting if you did manage to land something.
Yeah. What was your first live recording?
I don't quite remember what my first live recording was. I don't think he's going to forgive me for saying this, but Adrian Barry here was one of the first people to ask me to record him a demo. So obviously your first introduction to being on air was like being a sports reader. And he was like, will you record me a demo there? So I went into the studio, and I'd done loads of student radio at this point. I wouldn't say I fancied myself, but I'd been in front of a microphone plenty. And I recorded Adrian a demo, and he listened to it, and his feedback was this: well, it's not terminal. And I was like, well, okay, right. This is, maybe this isn't for me.
I could see how he would deliver that with a smile.
No, not with a smile. With a very sort of...
maybe, you know, research is your path, Owen.
Yeah, exactly. have you seen the comfy? Have you seen the comfy seat behind the glass?
So hold on now. When does Ger Gilroy slide into your email?
That was after that. Obviously, you'd already...
I'd already got my foot in the door at that point. So it was before. It was 2014.
Okay.
Yeah.
You remember the early years? Well, like now.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Like massively. Like, because I would have come in, done a few shifts, but then I had to go back and finish college and stuff. But we had a live blog on newstalk.com for the summer of 2014.
And
the World Cup year, yeah. So that was my summer job in 2014.
Was yourself and Raf Diallo doing something?
Like, Raf would have been great, but he would have been more on the weekdays. So yeah, the World Cup year, that was kind of my first media job doing that. And then went back to college, and just the way things worked out, a researcher job came up here in the summer of 2015 on the radio. And that was my kind of first full-time media job. So everything worked out. The timing just couldn't have been better if like, because you always had to wait for somebody to leave for a job to come up. If that person hadn't left their job for another 6 months, I probably would have been like, yeah, time to leave Dublin, because I loved what I was doing, but I'm not necessarily sure I wanted to, if there was other places that I really wanted to work at that point.
I'm jumping around here a bit, but how much do you think the media landscape has changed in the last decade? Since you started 2015?
Well, it's completely different. It is completely different. I mean, every single aspect of it has turned on its head in terms of what's expected from you in your role, no matter if you're a producer, a researcher, a presenter. And then obviously for every single audience member, the way in which you consume things is just turned on its head entirely. Now, I do think live sport is an interesting one. I think in terms of like the way in which we consume our live content is the same, like whether it's watching the Champions League at night or watching any sort of live sport, but also in terms of like live sport on the radio. Like I remember listening to Off the Ball commentaries on News Talk at, you know, 4:30 on a Sunday evening before going back to college. Like I listened to 4:30 commentaries on News Talk before going back to work on a Monday now. Like there are certain things that don't change, and there are certain aspects of broadcast that are still the same, whether it's, you know, our commentaries on a Sunday, whether it's the Sunday game. I know that maybe we're going to start to see the etching away of that in other aspects, like when it comes to highlight shows, like Football Focus going and stuff recently, maybe as a canary in the coal mine for that sort of thing. But in terms of live sports and action, I think it's pretty much the same. That's the easier way to answer your question, as opposed to listing off the ways it's changed. What's actually the same is a much shorter list.
Mm. Would you describe yourself as a home bird?
I wouldn't actually know, but I love home. I wouldn't describe myself as a home bird, though. Like, I wouldn't necessarily be itching to get home all the time. Like, for example, if it's championship season and my family are coming up to watch matches and stuff like that, that's kind of important enough for me.
Yeah.
Seeing the people at home is more important than actually being at home. But I absolutely love home. I love going. I actually love the fact that I get to go home to Kerry while not actually living there. I find that such a real point of privilege.
Why'd you ask that?
Because you left home at 18. And it's a trek to Kerry at the weekends. But Kerry's beautiful. And it's also home to you.
Yeah, like I absolutely adore Kerry. I love it. I'm very, very, very lucky to be from there. And yeah, like absolutely. I think it's an interesting one, though, because again, it kind of comes back to like the job availability point of, you know, 10, 15 years ago, that, you know, if there are obviously jobs like what we do in every part of Ireland, but the job that I want to do is in a big city, and it's in Dublin, and that was always a very big thing. That the opportunity that I wanted was never going to be available to me down there. But I love the fact that I'm from there, and that I get to get back there as much as I possibly can.
Are you a homebird?
No, it's probably the same answer. I love going back.
Cork's different, though. You have a city. As in, it's more built up. There's more opportunities there in terms of a wide array of things that you can do. Like, the media landscape in Cork is bigger than it is in Kerry.
Yeah. Would you lament that you couldn't say, do this job in Kerry, or does it bother you?
It doesn't bother me, though. No. Mm. It doesn't bother me now. Will it bother me in a few years' time? Maybe. But at the moment, no. I think, like, again, a bit of a tangent, I think Dublin had a real moment last year. I think, again, maybe it goes back to sort of like going away for a year in 2022. Like, I think there was probably a bit of a malaise around this city and stuff around COVID and being shut down. I think it's a very social city and stuff, and that didn't really help. Last summer was the first time I kind of remember looking around the city being like, you can kind of make a case this is one of the best places in the world. Yeah. Like, right now, granted, I'm making this opinion when the sun is shining and it was the best weather we've ever had in a summer. And it was also the summer I really realised that I'm a very weather-dependent person in terms of my mood and in terms of how optimistic I feel about anything. But I remember, like, last year just thinking, geez, we're in a really, really good place here. We're being absolutely ripped off for so many things, the vast majority of things, no question about it, but
we're making the most of it, we're getting on with it, and it's actually class.
Yeah, there's a real joy to where we are, and like that was kind of the first time in my life where I was like, this is no longer a functional thing, this is actually where I want to be.
Yeah, because if you put the cost of living aside, that's a big thing. It is a great place. It's a great city if you don't think about how much you're spending.
If you can hunker down until Paddy's Day, between New Year's Day and Paddy's Day, and you get through those 2.5 months, then you're lifting.
The beauty of tapping to pay is there's an element of delusion to how much money you're actually losing because you're not physically...
That's why we've embraced it so much in Ireland.
You're probably wondering why I'm asking about all this love of Kerry and homebird stuff is I want to get to the crux of the Kerry mafia.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I have a message in.
Yeah.
There was a maiden Kerry Mafia trip to Oma.
Already I know who sent it.
Where him, Mike, the old lad, myself ended up being at the Tyrone Centre of Excellence in 2013, ended up on the Tyrone website after Kerry had won a key game.
That for me was the beginning of the Kerry Mafia. So I'm not sure.
Should we
divulge as much as we possibly can.
Well, no, just the Kerry Mafia has become like something that the pundits now feel like they need to batter back when actually it is a WhatsApp group of you and your pals and that's it. But it has become something that maybe because we kept talking about it has entered into the folklore that needs to be, you know, carefully tended.
Maybe it does. So I don't want to give away too much information here, but I think I can reveal this. I might check with him, and if there's any kind of concern around this detail being divulged, you can scrub it from the internet. And Barry Lenehan, who is the new political correspondent for RTE, you know the guy I'm talking about. Himself, he was 2 years ahead of me in DCU, and he's from Kerry.
Is he?
He's of Kerry.
He's from Oregon.
He approached me one day and he said, there's a classmate of mine whose father is from Kerry. He lives in Dublin, but he's driving to Oma on Sunday for Kerry versus Tyrone in the National League. Do you want to come? I was like, bit random that you've made friends with your friend's dad, but I'm up for it. So Mike came and picked myself and Barry up on the Swords Road, and that was the first outing of the Kerry Mafia. The reason why it was coined was that on the way home, Mike saw that in Garvahi, the new centre of excellence was being opened by Tyrone GAA that very weekend. And instead of driving straight home after Kerry had recorded a famous win, he pulled a left, went into Garvahi. There were his teas and sandwiches, and they were delighted to see a few Kerry men in the ground. And they embraced us with open arms. And we posed for a photograph, and a photographer asked us. And we were published in some Tyrone newspaper or some free sheet. And then somebody
Spies.
And somebody on Facebook commented on it saying, the Kerry Mafia. And then that was it. And then it mushroomed from there. Like a whole range of ages and backgrounds and all that sort of thing has kind of happened. Like, by and large, it's a collection of Kerry people who live in Dublin.
I knew about it before I worked here because a member worked with me in a previous company.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right.
So this was known, a known entity.
And it's pretty unwieldy at this point.
Yeah.
And one of the main things that kind of comes as a result of the Kerry Mafia is a jamboree list, which is a kind of an infinite list of names of everybody that the collection of people encounters throughout a big GEA weekend. So these jamboree lists would really reach. There'll be a good one now next week for Kerry versus Cork
in
Killarney for the Munster final, but the best ones tend to be on like the jumbo weekends of like All-Ireland semi-final on the Saturday, All-Ireland semi-final on the Sunday. You're going to both games, you're around the city both nights, and it's just this mad collection of people, and it's a representation of Gaelic games folk as much as it is of Kerry people.
Is the Kerry Mafia seasonal?
We have a Christmas party. We do meet up for a bit of food every December. And there will be, I know Tommy Rooney actually gave the Kerry Mafia a lift from Ennis to Clare Castle for the first McGrath Cup game this year, and dropped him to the chipper afterwards. So early January, all the way until Christmas, I would say no, but obviously inter-county Gaelic football is seasonal. The county final and stuff like that would also encapsulate a fair few members as well. So no, I think it's year-round, much like GEA is year-round.
And much like the real Mafia, once you're in, you're in. There's no getting out.
Exactly. There's Druhuda Box or Swimming with the Fishes.
Do you want an embarrassing story?
Not particularly, but go for it.
There was a time he left the expensive ISDN box on one of his first matches for News Talk downstairs in a bus, went upstairs, and when he came down, it was gone.
I didn't expect this whole thing to be kind of like a This Is Your Life, but it's great, by the way. But I'd kind of forgotten that it's a bit of a... So the ISDN thing, this was one of the first match reports I had done. I can't quite remember the game it was. It might have been Monaghan versus Kerry or something like that, but I was living out in the north side of Dublin at the time.
Is this still 2015,
This is 2016, I think.
Just been trusted to go to matches, finally.
Just been trusted.
The terminal thing is like, we're going to allow you to speak on the radio.
Correct.
Yeah. Somehow Adrian had been bribed or something.
Yeah, exactly.
Like no one else was available.
A tiny bit of a pulse in this guy's career. We'll just we'll let him go and see if he can resuscitate it. And coming in from the north side on Dublin bus one day, I walked into the bus, put the Glen Sound, which is the big expensive ISDN kit worth thousands and thousands of euros, on the luggage rack on Dublin bus. And then I saw one of my mates upstairs in the bus. So I went upstairs to him and left the thing downstairs. We both got off the bus at the same time on Georgia Street, and we were chatting away, and I was like, oh no, I left the ISDN on the bus. So I rang up Dublin bus and he's like, no bother at all. The bus will be coming back to you there on Georgia Street there in about half an hour's time. Just wait for it. And I got on, and the bus driver was like, sorry, man, there is no box. There's no ISDN box here. And the police got involved. They checked the CCTV, and near North Wall, there was a gentleman who had taken the radio equipment off.
And he's here today.
the new radio station popped up in Dublin One.
That's amazing.
Shortly thereafter. To be fair, like, it was one of those that you could have been reprimanded over, and probably should have been reprimanded over, but it was just a very sort of you're an idiot sort of toned chat, and that was it.
They saw something. They decided, okay, fine, fair enough. They also changed the rule book in the company years later. So in between, how much does Halloween mean to both of you?
Very little.
I would have thought
our first show on
Halloween 2017
was the debut
of Off the Ball Breakfast, then known, and for many years known as OGBAM, the OG crew. Plenty call for them still. Ger Gilroy, Owen Shane and Tommy Rooney.
Yeah.
Talk us through it. What a time.
The only kind of item I really remember from that is we did a piece on the Dublin County Final, which had taken place the previous night, which was obviously the bank holiday Monday. And we got Anthony Moyles on to talk to us about that. I think he was in studio. It was Ballymun versus somebody, I think Vincent's.
Probably.
That's the extent of what I remember. I remember it was 2017.
Could have been the Fianna, could it, at that stage?
Could have been the Fianna.
Yeah, Vincent's peak. Maybe, no, still. But did they win in 15?
It was 2000.
So you were only in the door 2 years, and so you arrived full-time properly 15.
Yeah.
End of 17. Come on down.
Yeah, that's true. Actually, I don't think I applied for that job. It was Vincent's Ballymun, according to Matthew there. That's very true. I think I was probably very aware of that as well at the time, that it was possibly too soon, thrown into the deep end. So I don't think I actually applied for the job of co-presenter on that show. And then somebody was like, maybe you should actually go for it.
Do you remember how this came about? You were presumably the driving factor behind The Breakfast Show.
Do I remember how Owen getting the job came about?
Well, The Breakfast Show
Owen
debuted
and, Tommy.
And how the whole thing came together, yeah.
Yeah.
The design of it.
It's a long and boring story that involves like corporate research and corporate restructure. And do you want any of that detail? I'm not sure you do.
Pulling us away from being researchers on PM as well.
Yeah, so essentially we realised that we wanted to do more stuff than we were doing just on the evening show, and all of a sudden you were able to reach new audiences by streaming. So we got investment at a time when it was difficult to get investment, but they backed our vision of being able to create something new and make Off The Ball bigger than, because at that stage it was just a radio show in the evenings and a radio show at the weekends, and I think we had a Facebook page and that was it. There was maybe a Twitter account. So we started streaming. At that point we were streaming on Facebook and Twitter live. We didn't even stream on YouTube at the start. We're like, YouTube's never going to really take off. It's not going to amount to anything. So like things changed really quickly, but we needed people who were young and interested and keen on progressing, and couldn't find them, so we got on a Tommy.
Yeah, but it was like, it's crazy actually, now that you think back to it. There was, because like the show was so established now, trying to create something from nothing was kind of crazy. And even the little milestones, like Tommy used to be great for putting like show number one at the top, show number two, and then show number 100, I remember being a pretty big thing. And it was just very exciting, obviously, like an absolute shed load of imposter syndrome thrown in on a personal level. But as a show, it was like unbelievably exciting when you think back to it. And I guess the more the years go by, the more you kind of, it just becomes normal and it becomes a staple. And it's only kind of really when, you know, you kind of look back, compare like, say, the feedback you'd be getting from listeners 2 years on or whatever, and how it had embedded itself in people's morning lives was such a remarkable thing. And in many ways, actually, during COVID, that really kind of hit home. Some of the stuff that we did over COVID was very strong, like from the Mount Rushmore stuff. I think like Tommy's work on that was brilliant. Yeah, it was a mad old time.
When did you finish?
2014, I guess. Summer 2014, the end of the Olympics. I think probably the Olympic Games in 2014 was kind of the last big sports story. 2024. The Paris Games is probably the last big story I did in Off The Ball Breakfast. That was probably the last big sports event before going to the evenings and getting stocked up on sleep.
That's quite recent.
Yeah, nearly two years this September. It'll be, yeah.
Mm-hmm. How'd you know Owen was going to be so good?
From the first day he walked in to meet us, Owen had a very unique energy and has this very different path to get to where he got to. And despite his imposter syndrome, had a lot of confidence, and I would say has a brilliant delivery, but also like has a storytelling background and has done stand-up by the time he's 22 getting to us. I think you were 21 coming to us because you went to college quite young, right?
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, I think around then, yeah, 20 maybe.
And I just think, and he's sitting here beside me, so obviously, blah, 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 but he's got like a winning personality where people are like, oh, I want to hear what he has to say. And a very different style of questioning and incredibly funny. So, you know, it's like a pretty good gift there. Like, what a genius. I was spotting any of this. Like, it's just, Owen has charisma and not many people do. And you meet it, you're like, whatever the future is, come and have it with us. I say not many people do, but loads of people who work with us do have it. And I think we've been pretty good at giving people a platform to make mistakes. And the good thing about Breakfast was that, like, people were watching, but because, you know, it wasn't on the radio, it wasn't regulated, we could do what we wanted. Mm-hmm. And once you were hitting some KPIs, the sponsors didn't care either. So there was a creative freedom in that.
Is this the first time you've heard what Jer felt?
No, it isn't. Like, it's obviously deeply uncomfortable for me right now. I feel embarrassed. But there's also like a whole... it's hilarious because, like, why while you can think that of somebody in that moment, you also have to appreciate that somebody has to be really, really shit for a period of time for any of that sort of stuff to actually manifest itself. And like,
did you think you were that?
No, but it's one of the, obviously you can't tell yourself that you're shit at the time, but like now looking back on it, I realized I was pretty shit at what I was doing. But obviously Ger maybe thought that there's a possibility for this guy to get less shit as the years go by. And I think that might have happened.
I think I'm finally less shit
at this point. But God, I'd say like time is undefeated and all that. Just like you're 2 years into a career before being thrown in front of a microphone every single morning with like very little depth of knowledge. Because even if you're a sports fan, it's different being a sports fan compared to actually working in sport. And every single working minute is surrounded by this thing. Your level of knowledge and context and all that just isn't the same. So only 2 years of that, I don't think, stood me in great stead. Like relying on a lifetime plus 2 years probably wasn't enough to be like an authoritative voice on anything. But it was good. Went well.
When was the chemistry apparent? Was that straight away?
Do we have chemistry?
I don't think so.
No.
D2.
Once Ger figured out how to push any, like this is something that he does with anybody, but once he figures out how to push your buttons, that's when the chemistry arrives, you know? Once you feel yourself seething with Ger at 7:37 on a Tuesday morning.
Yeah, this is what we talked about beforehand. This is interesting where we're going.
That's when you know that you've made it as a pair with chemistry, when he's managed to get inside your head and rent-free, I think is the phrase, usually about Kerry GEA.
Well, you've got one button to push and that's it.
Well, Arsenal were irrelevant at that point. I'm glad that Arsenal's resurgence has kind of happened while I've not been working on the show, sure, because...
Off-Broadway, like.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. They were too low to be punched at during those years.
The other Owen does a good job of it.
Yeah, that's
true. He does a great job of it.
He does, but he's only figuring that out now, you see. Because, you see, we were getting, 4 days a week. Myself and Owen get one day a week, and over the period of a year, he's kind of figured out, oh, this is Sally Riley, you know?
But precisely the right moment. So, opening the kimono a little bit, we're actually recording this 2 weeks before you hear it. So Owen still has hope that they're going to qualify for the Champions League final and win the league. And when you actually see this, his little heart will have broken and Owen Doyle will be there feasting on it.
Yeah.
Mm, tasty.
Yeah, we actually, again, you, listener, will know this more than I know. I know that we're going to have Owen Doyle in with us one of the days next week, either Tuesday or Wednesday. So Owen Doyle has a decision to make. He can either, you know, get paid to watch one of the greatest football matches of all time happen again, or he can get paid to watch my heart break the pieces. That's Sophie's choice for him. That is, like, I don't know what he does. Like, there's going to be nothing entertaining about that Arsenal Atletico game compared to what's going to happen 24 hours later. But he could just be feasting over my misery on Tuesday evening when I'm trying to hold it together in a very professional manner, which I think he might actually go for. So whatever he's chosen, go back and check it now that you know what the eventuality was. You'll see what Owen Doyle's motives really are.
This escaped my research. Stand-up.
Yeah. Yeah.
Never knew this.
Again, probably another member of the Bauer family and... is well involved with this. So Cherry Comedy in Whelans, who Fiona Frawley, who's presenter on Spain's Breakfast Show, is a key component of. Herself and her husband Dwayne run it. Dwayne originally set this up back in DCU when we were there. So himself and a couple of mates just started stand-up in DCU and people just threw their hat at it. Everybody was probably terrible at it. I did it once or twice. And then we all graduated that year and he was like, I want to keep doing this thing. So he went to Whelans and Whelans were like, why don't you do your show in like the main room on a bank? Sorry, it wasn't a bank holiday Monday, but it was a Monday during the summer because it was July 2015. And Dwayne was putting the show together and he's like, do you want to like headline? Do you want to be our final act in the main room on Whelans on the first night of... Cherry Comedy. It was called Pop to Cherry Comedy back then. They changed it because, you know, fair enough. And
fucking Manosphere, what? Cancelled? You get cancelled if you say what you really think, what?
I'm doing inverted commas here. Headlined that on that occasion, and then a few of us went over to Edinburgh that year, and we did like a Cherry Comedy lineup over in Edinburgh, which was Sean Pollock in some ways, very enjoyable in other ways. It was actually a great week because, like, again, you're kind of like using Facebook trying to get gigs. And one of the favorite, one of my favorite gigs that I got was a man who allowed us to use his living room as a venue. So he just basically...
In return for...
I don't know, it's just friends. Like, he was obviously performing as well. He's like, I want to be a stand-up. I'm putting on a show. And he got in touch with us. We got in touch with him, and all of us performed in his living room. And there was, yeah, it was a very, very kind of like, yeah, interesting week. And then you kind of do a little bit more of it and the interest kind of wanes because that is a very, very difficult thing to do.
What was your style of comedy? Observational? Absurdist?
A bit absurdist, I guess. Quite deadpan, I'd suppose. But yeah, it's I definitely have.
He's doing it now.
And anybody who's kind of made it to a half decent level of comedy in Ireland, I have a 1,000,000% respect for, and I think they're the most incredible, brave people ever. Because one bad gig can break you, and you have to go through thousands of bad gigs to be even considered a mediocre stand-up in Ireland, or a stand-up of sort of half-level recognition in this country. So anybody who you think, who you've even referred to in your head or thought of as a sort of a medium deal when it comes to stand-up comedy, what they have gone through to get there in terms of their own strength and their own battling their own sort of lack of confidence or any setbacks that they've had has been incredible. And I just have so much respect for them. It's a really, really difficult thing.
What they say is, what you want is on the other side of embarrassment.
But it's a great phrase. Honestly, a great phrase. And I think maybe we are a little, we're too aware of cringe and embarrassment in this day and age. And the sooner,
as in Irish people or people?
People in general. I think the sooner you realise that cringe is part of the process. Which I've never said a sentence out loud before, but it sounds right. But I believe it. Cringe and embarrassment and all that, they're barriers to people maybe making the best out of themselves, I think.
Would you be affected by any online abuse?
Not anymore, no. I actually find, I'm sure you're the same, I find the most absurd stuff the funniest. Like, I remember it was one of the great benefits of going away for a year is that the Twitter, because Twitter was still strong back then, the Twitter mentions just got less and less and less and less after the first couple of days, and you'd be kind of free of any blowback to anything that you would have said about sport. So I had no blowback at all for a number of months, you know, went through the autumn, went through the most of the winter, and then it got to like near the end of the Six Nations in 2023, and I opened up my Twitter app and it was at from some guy I didn't recognize, and all it said was, yeah, that little ginger virgin. And I was like, what? What's this about? And he was like talking about some clip from Off the Ball from 12 months previously, the previous year Ireland had played Wales. And obviously I said something about Wales, and somebody was like, yeah, there was some dickhead in Ireland who said such and such. And your man tagged me, he's like, yeah, that little ginger virgin said it. And I was like, ah, yes, that's the job I need to go back to this year.
Did you look at the live comments when you were hosting the show?
No.
So much cooler than.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, it wouldn't be for me.
Why, as a matter of interest, why? You just wanted to concentrate?
No, because even if it's positive or negative, it will distract you. I'm not a very good multitasker. I think sometimes the positive comments are as distracting as the negative ones. Negative ones are a little bit more distracting.
Yeah, looking forward to those. Do you want to start your list?
Yes.
Yeah? Come on, let's talk about sport, he says. And there's plenty here. This will be a first, actually, for you. I had to be there, and that will be throwing to live clips.
Okay.
As in during the slot, which is very unusual for us. But we'll start with your beloved, will we? 2022 All-Ireland Senior Football Semi-Final.
Yes.
Kerry versus Dublin.
Yeah, this is probably the happiest I've ever been as a Gaelic football fan, I would suggest. This is the Shawnee Shea late kick to win the game for Kerry against Dublin, the All-Ireland Semi-Final in 2022. Kerry hadn't won the All-Ireland since 2014. The Dubs were a pebble in the shoe for Kerry. The last time they had beaten them in championship football was 2009. And there was a lot at stake going into this game. But crucially, Kerry were favourites going into this game. Conor Callaghan was out. There was a big opportunity for Kerry to win this game. They're dominant in the first half. And then they allowed Dublin to come roaring back into it in the second half. And you think to yourself, oh my God, this is happening again. And you start to think really grim thoughts about how like this could be a really damaging result for this team, because they just can't even beat a weakened Dublin team, and they've had a commanding lead, and they get that free late on, and Shaunie Shea steps up, even though Shane Ryan is coming out of his goals to come up and take it 50 yards out, pings it into the hill. The Kerry players leap around, jump around, and by the time the ball is kicked out again, it's game over. It's as close to a walk-off win as you would have got in the pre-Hooter era. And I remember just running down the steps of the stand, running back up to my seat, and just it was just perfect. It could not have gone any more. They couldn't be more pristine as a sporting moment. It's exactly how you would write it if you wanted perfect adrenaline and ecstasy. And the fact that they won the All-Ireland helped thereafter.
Yeah. You prefer that to the final itself?
Definitely, yeah.
Against Galway?
It was the Dublin thing. I mean, they say that the Kerry-Dublin rivalry in the 70s and 80s for a long time wasn't actually really a rivalry because it was so one-sided and Kerry won most of those All-Irelands. Like the Kerry-Dublin rivalry of the 2010s was exactly the same. Like if you were to use that metric, then was it really a rivalry, or did Dublin just beat Kerry every time they played Kerry? And there were so many near misses. The 2019 drawn final in particular, like to stop the five in a row was heart-wrenching. And like you look at the consecutive years of heartbreak. So 19 draw against Dublin, come so close to stopping the five in a row, they don't, they fail. 2020, that game against Cork, which was horrendous.
The Markeen one.
The Markeen game. 21 was COVID-gate and Tyrone. So those that happens in back-to-back-to-back years. Three horrendous exits from the championship. All the while Clifford's there.
It feels like it's Messi at Barcelona and Real Madrid keep winning Champions Leagues. What's going on? We've got the best player in the world and we're not doing the thing we're supposed to be doing.
Exactly. And then 2022 comes along and they look so good in the league. Like they win that league final pretty handsomely against Mayo. Everything that season had gone so well. And I think the first real setback that they had faced was Dublin coming back into it in the second half in Croke Park. And you just feel the noise in the hill. Like that's like they still very much believe that team is there. And they would be right to think that because they win the All-Ireland the following year. That is still a great Dublin team. Mm. So you're just thinking, God, disaster, curtains. Oh, like I'm not saying it because you're here, but like it's almost like how Cork lost the All-Ireland last year. Like for a lot of people, the best team in the country, they finally have their moment. Getting over the hill the first time is the hardest part. If you can just fall over the line and get it done, that's really important. But for Kerry in 22, they actually did get it done. And look, I've got no doubt that was important in terms of getting it done again last year and having that reservoir of belief, even though 23 and 24 were both sickening results as well.
Yeah. It's your only Kerry entry, right? And I suppose you want to diversify to different sports, but which is your favourite All-Ireland for Kerry in your lifetime/memory?
So that's a different question, actually. I think last year's one is my favourite All-Ireland, and just because of the way in which they won it. And after Tullamore and the game against Meath, I genuinely did think it was curtains. I wasn't playing the poor mouth. And I know there's a similar conversation happening now about Kerry this season and the injuries. I thought that Kerry were finished after that because of the quality of the performance against Meath and because of the players that were unavailable to them and coming up against a team of Armagh's quality who looked like the best team in the country going into that quarterfinal. So to beat them comprehensively after one of the greatest quarters ever put down by a Kerry team in Croke Park was sensational. Then to go up against Tyrone and hockey them in, I would say, the hottest day I've ever been in Croke Park was unbelievable. And then Donegal, like to cap it all off, like I don't think there's any love lost between Donegal and Kerry. I think Jim McGuinness is one of the greatest coaches in the history of Gaelic games, but if you're up against him, there's nothing more satisfying than beating Jim McGuinness in a big game in the All-Ireland Championship. So that's as satisfying and as pleasing and as gratifying as an All-Ireland could possibly be in an overall sense, but nothing like the singular moment of Shaunie's kick into the hill in 22.
Okay. Are you a good watcher, actually, generally speaking, of Kerry?
I've got better.
Yeah.
I've realised that like I need to drink less before I go to games and stuff like that. I need to be more relaxed. One pint, 2 pints. You can't be overly energised going in there. It goes for caffeine as well. I've definitely felt heart palpitations 2021. My Garmin was giving me some pretty grim feedback on the Tyrone-Kerry match. I think I actually posted a picture of that on Twitter and some dickhead online was like, geez, you're a really unhealthy man.
Sure, fuck's sake. All right, that was happy. This is sad. Ireland against New Zealand, Rugby World Cup quarter final 2023. Jesus Christ.
Yeah, I think
Ronan Kelleher, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Jordy Barrett's arm.
this is probably the only time I felt about the Ireland rugby team like I do about Kerry GA on an annual level, or how we would have all felt about the Irish football team in Prague and in Hungary, etc., etc. It was the only time that it got over that. Not because of, you know, any sort of disconnect with the team per se. It's only because of how previous quarterfinals have gone. Like, particularly 2019, that was a complete battering. 2015 was a battering as well, let's be honest. So 2023 comes along and finally Ireland are in a close game in a quarterfinal, the best team they've had in a World Cup, the best chance ever. And that all kind of is part of how you feel in those moments when they're chasing this game. And as you say, like Barrett on Kelleher holding him up and all that. But I've kind of picked this part of that because of how you feel, but also because of that weekend. It was really amazing. Like, it was Nathan's idea to send me hitchhiking to Paris for that particular quarterfinal, which was, of course, great crack for everybody. Like, and when the truckers' protest was happening recently, it kind of brought memories rushing back of like being in a couple of trucks going down to Rosslare, and like the cold sweat of thinking back to trying to get a lift down to Rosslare and get across the water to get to France on that occasion, and trying to hitchhike from, was it Cherbourg all the way to Paris over the course of half a day, and nearly getting stuck in a petrol station, nearly having to kind of basically sleep for the night in a petrol station in Cannes before a man generously drove me onto Paris. And then it's just this, it's party time in Paris for every single Irish person who's there, in a very un-rugby-like crowd. It is like a soccer crowd. It's like a GAA crowd. Mm. The Rue de Clichy outside O'Sullivan's pub is like, there's lineouts going, there's people throwing balls around. It seems like everyone from every part of Ireland has actually descended on Paris for a rugby game, which was very unusual. And then the game delivered, and it was, like, obviously objectively amazing, horrendous from an Irish standpoint, but an amazing weekend of rugby.
I'd say very few negative entries have been in "you had to be there," the ratio of positive to negative memories. But it's interesting, of all the options you had, you picked on paper heartbreak, but it's more the memories around it.
Yeah, and also how we kind of felt about that team at that point. Like, that's coming off that Grand Slam year. It's a very, very special moment for that Irish rugby team, and there's no certainty that we will have that ever again. Because say what you like about rugby, in terms of punching above our weight in a relatively popular sport on a global level, like, rugby's our best shot. It has been our best shot. I know we'll have one or two athletes. I know the boxers every 4 years at the Olympics as well will be in that category. But compared to the soccer team in particular, when it comes to major team sports around the world, rugby is one of the things that Ireland have had a capability of calling themselves world class in. And this was the best they've ever been, for my money, certainly during my lifetime. Mm. This 2023 team. So it's still a sickener. Like, I'm not sure if the opportunity will be the same at the next World Cup. Granted, there's an easier draw. There'll be plenty of Irish down in Australia, but this was on our doorstep as well, which rubs the salt in the wounds a little bit.
Even though we lost, we won. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, let's go with that. Yeah. No,
I just remember James Tracy in studio, and that was a Saturday night, wasn't it, that game?
Yeah.
I was in the Monday morning. First question we asked him about it, it's a very open-ended question of, like, how do you feel? And it was just a pause and just a... And that was a great summation.
Yeah, that was it. Yeah, and I think a lot of people in the stadium that night were just kind of rooted to their seats afterwards. Mm. Just didn't really know where to look. It was a horrendous moment for Irish rugby, because I'm not sure that they'll have as good an opportunity as that. The draw looks good for the next time. But I think once you've tasted that as well, nothing kind of can satisfy you that much. Like, you'll remember the Six Nations the year after, and how everybody was, you know, pretty lukewarm about the fact that Ireland were on course for a Grand Slam before going to Twickenham. Like, oh, it's just another Grand Slam. But I think we'd probably get a greater appreciation after 2 years of actually how great that team was, and how much that 2023 was to be celebrated.
Mm. The third entry is one of the more incongruous entries in "You Had to Be There's" history, because on paper, I mean, what's anything to this game? Argentina versus Panama, international friendly 2023, the first game post-World Cup, but of course there is so much in this.
Yeah, okay, so like, people would have listened to the podcast that I put out last year, so just to give a very brief potted history to this game is that, like, I went to South America with the intention of being in Argentina for the World Cup in 2022. At the time, I thought it was going to be Messi's last World Cup. Obviously, that's not the case now, but I thought it'd be cool to spend some time in Rosario, spend some time in his hometown, see, like, how Argentina actually interact as a people with one another when this thing is happening. And also it was going to be a Summer World Cup for them for the first time ever, really. So, there was a whole host of reasons why I wanted to be there for the World Cup. But I ended up just traveling really slowly, kind of underestimating how long it would take. And like, I hadn't even got to South America. I was still in Central America by the time the World Cup started. But the first game, they obviously end up losing to Saudi Arabia. And I'm like, brilliant. I've made a brilliant decision here, not in Argentina for this World Cup. This is absolutely fantastic. And obviously, as the weeks go by, that opinion starts to change where Argentina start to pick up a bit of form. Yeah. They start to course through the knockout stages, getting lucky in a couple of different rounds. And I'm only as far as Colombia when they actually win the World Cup. One of the greatest games of football ever played, Argentina versus France. One of the worst moments of my life, watching that, knowing that was my plan, that I should have been down there, but I screwed the whole thing up and I wasn't down there. Anyway, fast forward a couple of months and I do eventually get to Argentina. I'm down there, and it turns out that when I'm in Buenos Aires, actually coincides with Argentina's first game in at home since they've won the World Cup. So this is the big homecoming for Argentina, and all of a sudden things have flipped in my head. I'm like, actually, this thing has worked out perfectly, because I've ended up making friends with these couple of, with these two Irish lads, one of which is extremely rich, and he's put me up in the Marriott Hotel in Buenos Aires. I'd never stayed in the Marriott before, as has already been covered on this slot. I was extremely broke at this stage in my life, and I was walking around the executive suite in the Marriott, and this is not hyperbole, I think I was the poorest person that has ever walked around the executive suite in any Marriott hotel anywhere in the world, to the point where staff were coming up looking for my room key. Like, you wouldn't do that to a VIP. They were coming up to me, looking at me and being like, this guy is in off the street, show us your room key. And I'd have to prove to them that I actually did have a room key. Anyway, after a couple of days in this hotel, we start to notice that the staff have actually upped their game in terms of how they're dressing. The men have started to wear these kind of like sky blue ties, and everything's kind of up the level. It feels like there's extra security outside the hotel. And one of the lads asks one of the security men, what's going on here? Why have things ratcheted up a small bit? And the security tell him, well, there's a big game in town this week. And we're like, oh my God, what's... No way. Like, as in my head is like, this has turned so far in my favor, like that the Argentina national team is going to be staying in this hotel. Like, incredible. Like, could be in a lift with Scaloni or with Messi or whoever else is involved. So you try and get tickets for the game. I try and get onto my contact who had sorted me with Boca Juniors tickets the previous week. He just like laughs at me. He's like, no chance you're getting tickets to this game. We go around to El Monumental, see if we can pick one up there. We can't. Doesn't matter. We're like, grand. We're in the same hotel as a team. We go back to our hotel, watch the game there, go out into the balcony, and we see this team bus coming down the main promenade in Buenos Aires, and it comes around the obelisk and it comes driving up our side of the street, and it stops outside the hotel. We look down and there are players coming in off the bus, and we rush downstairs because this is our moment to actually meet these Argentina players. So we get down to the reception and we see these lads in tracksuits walking in, but it's not the Argentina team, it's the Panama team who were playing them that night. And it was their worst, most crushing moment, even more crushing than watching the World Cup thousands of miles away. And we go downstairs and I've given Matthew a picture here. We end up getting a picture with one of the lads in the Panama team, and we all look absolutely devastated. His name is Jorge Luis Serrano. He's wearing his boots there, and we kind of pick up the boots and we look at them, and there was a man beside Jorge Luis Serrano who was the PR man for the Panama national team. And I was like, so this guy, tell me his name. And he gives us his name, and we googled like the match report, and Jorge Luis Serrano was an unused substitute that night for Panama against Argentina. So I couldn't even say that those boots were on the same pitch as Messi at any stage in the game, and it was a crushing moment.
at this point, what's your Spanish like?
Good, yeah, very good. So probably chatting to the I still have the Panama PR fella's number, actually, if ever you want to get anybody on from the Panama national team.
How's your canal, I can be your
contact on that.
That was some year in your life, wasn't it? Jesus, the amount that you got done that year away.
Yeah, got a fair bit done. Yeah, didn't get to Argentina for the World Cup though, sadly, but got a lot done.
Final two here. I remember this on Off the Ball Breakfast. Do you remember that, the three of us?
Yeah.
It was good, wasn't it? Three best friends. I remember this particular ball game from 2024. One of your last things I'd say you did with the Off the Ball Breakfast Show, was it?
Yeah, Ger was off the next morning, so I was...
It was you and... Aisling.
Yeah, and yourself, yeah, the three of us. So, look, this is an Off the Ball item. You can go back and watch this and...
You brought it up again recently on the show, because it was happening again, wasn't it, on
PM? Every show of Tuesday is the Addison Ball game, a centuries-old game that takes place in the heart of Backwater, England. Flew to Birmingham and then got a taxi about 40 minutes up the road to this town called Atherston. People might be familiar with this. It's something that tends to go viral every year.
We have a video here. Yeah, you can talk over it.
Yeah, so it's this big leather ball that gets thrown out of a window, as you can see here, and the locals, they all try and get their hands on it. And this thing is then kicked up and down the street, a street called Long Street for a number of hours. Now, there are two rules in this game. The ball has to stay on Long Street, and the other rule is that you're not allowed to kill anybody. So you would have seen there a moment ago that a child was given the opportunity to kick the ball for the first hour or so. It's kind of frivolous stuff like that, where kids are allowed to kick it up and down, and then it turns into this, which is all-out scrums. So if you're the person who's in possession of the ball when the hooter sounds at 5 p.m, you have won the Addison ball game. These lads are generally in teams, so what you've got is a lad who's down at the bottom of, 40 bodies at the moment on top of the ball, and his teammates are fighting off other lads who want to come and take the ball off him. The ball generally bursts at the bottom of the scrum. There's steam coming off it, as you'd see like in a scrum on a cold day at Thomond Park. And at the end of it all, you get crowned as, the most important lad in Brexit land, is kind of how I would describe it. I do remember kind of like trying to get an interview with the winner that year. So I followed the lads. He was kind of like being carried shoulder high, the lad who had won it, by his teammates. And they go into this pub, and I wasn't allowed into the pub. They closed the door behind him. And I asked one of the other competitors, would you be available for an interview, please, just about your experience for the Addison ball game today? You can edit this afterwards. You can bleep it in, because I think bleeping myself, censoring myself.
Charlie's sitting up here now in the box.
He turned around to me and he's like, where are you from, mate? And I was like, I'm from Ireland. I'm a journalist here from Ireland. He's like, right, I'll tell you what. You take your Irish equipment and fuck off back to Ireland, you cunt. And he was wearing a British and Irish Lions rugby top, which is the best part about it. But pretty rattling in the moment, so I went to a Costa Coffee, calm down, just stop
calmed
shaking.
Down with an Americano.
Stop shaking, and then got a taxi back to the airport pretty quickly.
It looks grim enough.
It's very grim.
Stop.
It's very grim.
All off their head in coke as well? There must be a lot of coke floating around, right?
I'd say so. Definitely on alcohol anyway, but I wouldn't be surprised if there's something harder involved. I was chatting to like one of the champions beforehand, and like his daughter was talking about how she's like, Daddy, I don't like it when all the men are beating each other up. And I was like, why is she here? Why are kids here? Like, what is going on here?
You gotta show them their tradition,
But on a lighter note, you interviewed Josh Pugh.
That's where you're from.
Josh comedian, who people might know him as, but that was the gaffer.
He was the fellow who threw the ball out the window. The window out of the ball. He was the fellow who threw the ball out of the window at the start, Josh Pugh. It's a celebrity who does that every year.
Okay.
So Gordon Banks did it once.
Do you have to be a local?
Not really, but...
Banks off that Stoke, isn't he?
Off that place, off that.
Yeah.
Brexit land.
It's bringing back memories. Like, you got out of there. You did well to get out of there unscathed physically.
There's plenty of media who actually cover it. Like, a lot of people descend on the town every year, and I guess you can understand why they're sceptical of the media, but I don't think there's any tone. I don't think there's any editorialising of what goes on there. I think the raw footage itself tells a fair story.
Would you recommend people going to cover it?
I would actually, like, as long as you can withstand seeing that stuff. Like, it is pretty grim. Nobody's going to fight you. Like, the only reason I had a bad experience is because I literally asked somebody for an interview with a microphone. Some people are very paranoid of the media, and that individual was. So
experts. Had enough of experts.
If you want to go as a punter, I would highly advise it. Like, it's a pretty cheap trip over to Birmingham.
One more to go. Mm-hmm. The NFL Draft Nashville 2019. Should we just play the video here to start with and play off it?
It's the perfect place for a draft. 150,000 people here tonight. 150,000 people. What an amazing town. The perfect environment for a draft. It was in New York for what? 2 million years? Now they finally came to Nashville.
That's our Uber right there.
Would you like to see him stay here?
Yes, of course. This place is the perfect place for the NFL draft. Every pick got a cheer, except for Roger Goodell.
I wanted to pick something American, but I think possibly that's just my best experience of an American sports event. NFL Draft 2019, Nashville, as I had outlined there in my inebriated state.
The perfect place
for a draft. The NFL Draft is actually an amazing thing to see, and I think Nashville is kind of the perfect place for an NFL draft because it is like a bachelor party, bachelorette party mecca when it comes to people from the United States. And this became mecca for NFL fans from all around the country who fly in their NFL jerseys to watch the pick. I think Kyler Murray was the first pick in that particular draft. Is he still with the Cardinals?
No, he's got released.
He got released, so he's obviously wasn't a great. I don't know who else was beyond him, but that's the only kind of piece of trivia I'd have for you from it.
Matthew, intrigued there, the producer in the box. Why were you there?
So my mate was getting married in Alabama the previous week. So we went on a road trip from Texas up to Tennessee, finished in Nashville. We realized that our hotel was unbelievably expensive in Nashville. Oh. Didn't know why until we landed there and we're like, oh my God, the NFL draft is in town. So it was, yeah, genuinely, really, really great thing to experience. But I remember kind of waking up in the hotel and opening Twitter and I was like 20 plus that notification when like they can't handle any more notifications. I turned to Jason. I was like, why is my social media hopping off? And he's like, because of the interview last night. I was like, what? And we interviewed. And he said that we left the pub and he said, I saw a bright light coming towards us down the street and I went straight up to this guy, Brent Ramanda.
Who subsequently was on the show
and volunteered ourselves. Why are you going around Nashville at 3 a.m. with a camera is the question I'd have, but he got what he needed. And I think, again, going back to Nathan, I think he was the person who kind of lit the clip on fire on social media by saying, everybody, Owen's in America, he's on TV, and he's pissed drunk. And I was. But I own it now.
What channel did it go out on?
ABC.
Wow.
The local affiliate in Tennessee.
The local affiliate
in Tennessee. It's still a sizable population,
yeah.
I bet.
Yeah, still ABC.
I remember that moment in the office. You get those days every so often, very rarely though, that there's a different energy to the place. And it was the moment people realised, Owen's gone viral here. And I don't know if you were back yet.
No, it went viral the very next day.
Yeah, yeah.
So I was still very much away. And we still had the next, because we did another night out in Nashville then the following day. Definitely, yeah. That was, fear is one way you describe it. But it subsided in time. I think because I've got rid of the beard now and I look like a different person. I can now stand over that and be like, actually. That wasn't me.
Same beard meeting the Panamanian footballer as you did meeting Brent Romano or whatever.
Yeah. Brent Romanda. True. But that I've.
Ray's brother.
With shearing the facial hair, you shear that person. So I can now stop and laugh at that individual who's not me.
Yeah, how much have you evolved since then?
So much. Mm. So much. Great maturity.
Mm. That was very enjoyable.
I enjoyed it. I hadn't quite anticipated that this is your life aspect of it, so sorry for coming unprepared emotionally.
I think it's kind of become that.
Yeah, it has, I guess, yeah.
The last few months, you know.
Mm-hmm. Owen's nodding away going, haven't seen any of them. Because we haven't done any in about 6 months, so.
Well, except for the two we've done the last week. But yeah, that is true to an extent. Thank you for doing it.
Thank you for having me.
It was very enjoyable. As a listen.
I loved it.
Owen Shaynes, you had to be there.
You had to be there.
Off the Ball Breakfast.
With Viagra Connect 50 mg film-coated tablets. Contains sildenafil for adult men with erectile dysfunction. Maximum dosage 150 mg tablet per day. Always read the label. Buy online at viagraconnect.ie. Subject to suitability following pharmacist consultation.
Rugby.
There was a gulf in the two teams and that was the most disheartening thing. And does that mean that Leicester can't come back? No, of course they can rebuild, but the mountain is bigger than it's ever been.
Join in the obsession. Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.